No, you tell it.
No, you.
I'm not telling it.
You should totally tell it.
Well, you should tell it.
No, you tell it. No, You Tell It is a series that switches up the storytelling. So each performer writes a true life tale and then, switching with a partner, performs the other person's story, giving everyone involved the chance to share their own stories and experience someone else's. A year ago, we were able to expand Know You Tell It by offering workshops at QED, a place to show and tell in Astoria. These workshops are open to writers of all levels looking to switch up their story. As a result, we've been fortunate to work with so many amazing storytellers we never would have met otherwise, many of whom have come back to take part in our live shows at Jimmy's No. 43. Give a listen to our very first workshop showcase performed live at QED on February 3rd, 2015. Thank you, everyone, for coming out on this beautiful evening for Know You Tell It. This is our first Know You Tell It at QED here in Astoria, and we're very excited to be here tonight is a part of a lot of firsts, which I'm excited to tell you about. I've really gotten to know and enjoy working with all these ladies who took our very first workshop that we taught here at QED. Over the past month, we've worked together as a group to workshop their true life tales inspired by our theme, Revelation, on the page. And then they flip scripts, and tonight they'll be performing each other's stories for you in front of a live audience. This is the first time that these stories will be performed in front of a live audience, and it's also the first time that the author gets to hear their partner perform their story. So we've done the kind of really mean thing of making the author sit up on stage and enjoy the experience with you. And like I said, I've really enjoyed getting to know all these ladies over the last month we've been working together, and I wanted you, I know some of you are here to see your friends, but for the other ones, to get to know the author a little bit before their partner does their story. So our first author this evening is Alessia. Will you please just step up next to me? They've all nervously been waiting all day, because part of the Know You Tell It tradition is that I ask the author a question, a little Q&A, and nobody knows what their question is, and we're all sick, by the way, so this is like a group effort, and we all smell like peppermint oil, because we cleansed before to bring you our best voices and stories. I wrote the questions about an hour ago in my cold medicine days, so you can blame that if any of them are a little strange. But Alessia, you said, and when we first met you, that you live nearby.
I do.
And that you saw Know You Tell It on the plethora of offerings that there is here at QED, which check out their website, both shows and classes. There's a little something of everything for everyone. And so what was it about Know You Tell It that made you be like, that's it! I'm signing up for that one.
Well, the idea of being able to get back into writing, which I haven't done in a little while creatively, was very appealing, and then the idea that I wouldn't have to tell my own story on stage was also pretty cool, so take the emotion out of it, you know? I'm really glad. It was a cathartic and wonderful, happy experience, so
hope you like it. Yay! I'm going to sit up here with you for moral support. So first up this evening is the story Casper Evelyn Birdie, written by Alessia Donati, and performed by Violet Olds.
Casper Evelyn Birdie. I wake up and look to my left, where my husband would normally be snoring away. As I feel the imprint on the sheets left from his body, I remember that he had to work overtime this weekend, and that he wouldn't be home until that evening. I go about my morning routine, but then I stop short at the bathroom door. There's a sign, scotch-taped, at eye level, that reads, "Caution, open door slowly, bird inside." In a pre-caffeinated haze, I can't even begin to imagine why this sign is here. Bird? What kind of bird? Was the bathroom window open and somehow a bird flew in and it couldn't get back out? Did I wake up in some sort of twilight zone and there's a great cassowary awaiting me inside of my shower? I have to go to the bathroom, but there is no way I am opening that door. I called John. What the fuck is this note all about? I asked him before he could even say hello. Well, when I was leaving this morning, there was a parakeet on the road, right outside of our gate, just sort of sitting there. I didn't know what to do, and he looked sick or hurt or something, so I put him in the bathtub. Don't worry, it can't fly. I'm going to figure out what to do when I get home, he tells me. Great. He wouldn't be home for hours, and it wasn't like I had any other options for a toilet inside of our little one bedroom. Like a complete lunatic, I knock on the door before entering and say, little bird, I'm coming in. Please don't freak out and fly at my head. I tentatively enter and look inside the tub. No bird. Ugh. I look around and see that it has flown to the top of the medicine cabinet and is looking down at me with that sideways avian glare. It is in a complete state of distress. And I mumble to myself, that bird can't fly my ass, idiot. Then to the bird. Okay, everything is cool, little guy. I'm just going to pee real quick and then you'll have the place to yourself. My reassurance didn't help. The budgie goes into full panic mode and flies around in a frenzied flap of wings before crash landing on the shower rail, the little tuft of feathers on its chest rising and falling rapidly. If I flush, the noise might send the thing over the edge, so I close the top of the toilet and back out of the bathroom. I call John back. That bird is flying all over! What? When I put my hand down, it just sort of hopped right on. He wasn't flying when I was there. Of course, what my husband was trying to say was that he had no idea the parakeet could fly. In the moment, I'm thinking to myself, of course. It must have been my anxious energy that caused the bird to fly. John, the fucking animal whisperer. I couldn't stay to remedy the situation because I was due at the chiropractor's in 15 minutes. And as I'm walking there, I feel an immense guilt. What if the bird needs water or food? It was so scared, and it's my fault that it was frightened. I wonder if I should stop at Staples and get some found little blue and gray parakeet signs made up. I tell anyone who will listen at the doctor's office about the bird in my bathroom, and everyone thinks it's hilarious. They can't wait for me to come back next week so I could tell them what happens in the next installment of The Budgie in My Bathroom. It's the first time that it dawns on me that this is a pretty crazy story and that there is anything remotely funny about it. I start to laugh at myself. As I walk back outside on a sunny summer day, I convince myself that it was kismet. John didn't find the bird. The bird found him. It was just fate. Pure and simple. Growing up, I had a parakeet named Pinecone. Not Pinecone. I thought he looked like a pinecone, but it was obviously not a pinecone, therefore, Pinecone. I remembered that Pinecone enjoyed George Harrison's Cloud Nine album and the sound of running water. I pick up the pace and rush home as quickly as possible to try these parakeet soothing methods out on our new pet. When I get into the bathroom, I do not see the bird, but I leave the tap trickling water. Then I dig some raw sunflower seeds out of the back of the fridge and leave a little plate, just in case. I find the full album of Cloud Nine has been uploaded to YouTube. In a full 49-minute version. Perfect. I leave the house hoping that George's sultry, take my love, it fits you like a glove, will keep this bird chilled out until I get back. I'm practically skipping to the pet store as I brainstorm names. I settle on Casper Evelyn Birdie. Casper, because his coloring and little round head reminds me of the cartoon Ghost. Evelyn Birdie, because my favorite artist name is Evelyn Birdie. B-E-R-D-E. I get to the pet store and ask to see small bird cages. I don't even buy the cheapest one. Casper deserves a nice new home. I buy the $7 organic bird seed. No bird of mine is going to eat some weird GMO seeds. I tell every employee at the pet store my bird in the bathroom story. They look at me like I'm insane. I don't care. I'm going to take care of this little bird. I can be just as nurturing as John. Sure, when I was 5, I accidentally killed my pet hamster, Charlie. Not such a great track record for caring for small animals. But it was just so cute that I squeezed him just a little too hard. I'm still going to go to heaven, right? In any case, here's my chance to turn over a new leaf. When I get home, I carefully fill one little bin in the birdcage with water out of the Brita. I put some of the fancy bird seed into the feeder, and I decide that Casper, Evelyn, Birdie is going to like this cage so much, I'll just leave it there on the floor, and I'm sure he will just hop right in. Just like he hopped right into John's hands. I knock at the door again and whisper, excitedly, "Casper, I have a new home for you." When I open the door, the bird is lying on its side next to the toilet. Casper looks so calm and peaceful, its wings tucked down at each side. I convince myself for a matter of seconds that Casper is just taking a nap, so I leave the cage and shut the door again, hoping that the prospect of new accommodations will rouse the bird. Of course, we all know that bird is not asleep. When I quickly go through the first three stages of the Kubler-Ross grief model, I hit stage 4, depression. I am inconsolable. I enter the millennial stage of grief that we all know well, Googling. I Google things to see where my caretaking could have possibly gone wrong. I was angry about the bird at first when I woke up, but from then on, I only had the best intentions. I'm regressing through my grieving stages. I find a website that tells me parakeets should not eat sunflower seeds. It is completely my fault that Casper is lying dead on my bathroom floor. I call John. He doesn't understand what I'm saying because I can't stop crying. I explain that there's no way I can deal with this dead bird. He has to pick it up when he gets home. He was so worried about me that he rushed home as fast as possible. I thought he hated the bird in the bathroom. Why are you so upset? He picked up the bird and its little head flopped lifelessly to the side. I lose it all over again. I can't breathe because the sobbing is so intense. I had just set up these expectations about our little visitor and what future realities might await. The thought that I created took on a life of their own, and with this parakeet dying, the life of my expectations died too. I was grieving over the loss of a daydream. I also expected that if I could care for this bird and do a great job, my husband would recognize that and maybe want to have children with me. We were going to care for this bird together. We called 311 to see what you were supposed to do with a dead animal in New York City. They said if you have a backyard and the pet is under a certain weight, you can bury it. If you do not have a backyard, you have to put it in the trash, but adhere a sign to the garbage bag that says, "Warning, dead bird inside." With no yard, we were forced to do the latter. Passerbys were morbidly curious and took photos of the sign. William Shakespeare wrote, "Expectation is the root of all heartache." Right on, Bill. Now, over a year has passed since Casper died. John moved out a few weeks ago. We are getting a divorce. I wonder if, when I start cleaning out of the apartment and throw away the detritus of our 6 years together, should I put a sign that reads, "Warning, dead marriage inside"? Rest in peace, Casper, Evelyn, Birdie. I'm sorry we didn't have more time together.
I have to say, one of my favorite Know You Tell It moments, when you said about putting the sign that, you know, have warning that burns, like, Alessia leaned over and goes, it's true.
It's all true, actually. But that part is scary.
I'm like, yes, now I believe you. I didn't believe you in any other writing workshop. Great job. So now, switching things up, we're going to put Violet in the hot seat. She wrote our second story this evening. And my question for you is, one of my favorite things about Know You Tell It is getting to be friends with everyone on Facebook and seeing your various goings-on. So I've seen you posting a lot lately about being accepted into a comedy festival.
That's correct.
And I just wanted to know more about it. Woo! Woo!
It's the Finger Lakes Comedy Festival, and it's in Ithaca, New York this weekend. My set's at 6 p.m. at some bar in Ithaca.
Bus trip.
And
how long have you been doing stand-up?
I started stand-up in August.
Amazing. Congratulations.
Yep.
Do you have a best heckler story or the proudest moment or... Just like, I kick ass, I'm already in this festival this weekend.
I would say my proudest moment was probably my first show, which I took a stand-up class, and it was my graduation class. So it was a very trying process to get through it, because I guess I have roots in storytelling, and so my first set that I ever wrote was just a story with a lot of humor injected into it. So to be able to actually get to the point that I was writing stand-up material was a huge accomplishment for me.
Congratulations, and we're so glad that you're part of this. So now, switching things up, here is Swipe Right for Humanity, written by Violet Olds and performed by Alessia Donati.
I'll try not to cough through this. Sorry, I'm a little sick, as we said earlier.
Feel
sick.
Free.
I know. All right. So I'm going to tell a story called Swipe Right for Humanity. Humanity. It's the quality or state of being human. It's the quality or state of being kind to people. It is, quite simply, all people. In the modern, fast-paced dog-eat-dog world, we often lose touch with humanity and then seek out ways to find it again. We volunteer, do yoga, meditate, travel, go to New Age hippie bullshit retreats. We've almost all come to the point where we're looking around, trying to find that source to put us in touch with the state of being human and of kindness within a world that is seemingly so harsh. I went looking for that. And through the simultaneous pursuit of also wanting to get laid, I found humanity in the most unexpected ways. I found humanity in Tinder. And through finding humanity, I found myself, my true, amazingly different, eccentric, open, accepting, and awesome self. I came to New York very unexpectedly because of a work opportunity. I had 1.5 days to prepare and pack my bags. When I stepped off the plane at JFK, I had stepped into a city where I knew no one and knew nothing about it except for what I was told on TV. I was literally embarking on the biggest journey and adventure of my life, and by God, did it turn out to be a doozy. I eventually grew tired of my own loneliness. I needed companionship, and quite frankly, I needed to get laid. I just wasn't doing it for myself anymore. I kept hearing the all-knowing internet talking about Tinder, so in a complete what-the-hell moment, I downloaded the app. Tinder is a quirky thing. You put up a few pictures of yourself, type up a few words, then you gets to swiping. You go through the people. You swipe right if you like them, swipe left if you don't. It's an easy concept that started to yield some uneasy results. Tinder confirmed my thing for dudes with beards and glasses. The hipster lumbersexual look, if you will. But it also exposed my own prejudices, like not swiping right on anyone whose names I couldn't pronounce. The first few dates were awful. I didn't know how to conduct myself, and I felt like the conversations were scripted. I was making the same stupid jokes over and over again. I was stuck in a rut of vanilla blandness, trying hard to appease whatever the other person thought I should be, in the most basic of levels. It was awful. I hated myself. Or rather, I hated the reflection of myself that I thought I had to project. I kept going through the same motions, explaining my somewhat complicated job, my fondness for my home state of Florida, how driving the city isn't that bad, how much I've moved. It was boring. I realized eventually that this was bullshit. Complete and utter bullshit. The whole idea that you have to put your best face on to impress another person is, well, bullshit. We should never be made to feel like we have to be something that we aren't just to bang somebody. Because eventually, that person will come out, or you're just going to become a miserable fucking human being. And believe me, that's no way to live. This realization came to me in the middle of a date, when I realized that the corned beef hash that I was shoving in my face was more exciting than the conversation, and really the date that I was on. I lost it.
I started telling these crazy stories about marrying a corporation just to divorce it and get its money. How kids these days have it easy because of their access to porn. Of how I can make a guy come without touching his dick. I found myself in a diner in Queens, busting through all those dumb walls that we construct around us. I just couldn't fucking take it anymore. Through this instance, I found my true self. Or really, the courage to truly embrace who and what I was. I decided to live my life in the open. Being open and completely honest about my wants, my desires, my kinkiness, my everything. I didn't want to live in the shadows of societal norms. I wanted to feel the warmth of sunshine upon my face as I stood proud about everything that I am. And this is where the magic happened. When I made the commitment to myself to live open and honestly, the rays of sunlight started to shine through the gray clouds, and the world in turn opened itself up to me. My experiences of the people that I met on Tinder from that point on became intense, both emotionally and sexually. People were able to pick up on my authenticity and warmth, and as a result, they began to spill their guts. There were a few, let's say, interactions that ended up having long-lasting effects on me, and they were all of a remarkably positive nature. One of the most monumental nights that I've had in a long, long time, if not my entire life, was a night spent with a professional comedian. We laid in his bed for hours, fooling around and talking. We spent more hours discussing relationships and sexuality than we actually did fucking. I was even able to share a seriously exciting moment with him when he received the email that he was being booked on a late-night talk show for the third and final time. His energy after reading that email and sharing it with me was indescribable. Something truly amazing. We also talked about comedy and how I had a dream since I was a kid that I wanted to do stand-up. He told me that I was funny, naturally funny, and that I should seriously give it a try. It took a lot to process that statement, but his words have never left me. He was the final push I needed to commit to doing comedy. As it turned out, Mr. Comedian was a complete moron when it comes to post-coital relationships, but I forgive him for that. The inspiration that he gave me is all that I needed from him. If he, in his stupidity, can make it professionally, I know I can too. And so, comedian with a toilet in the stairwell hallway. Thank you. Thank you for gifting me with the courage to pursue my dreams of comedy. Another pivotal moment happened one night when, on yet another seemingly random date, an older man in his mid-40s had met me at the bar near my place. We had a few of the obligatory Tinder date beers, made the small talk, and then decided to go back to my place. We awkwardly made out on my couch bed and then began to do those adult things that we do. He was good at it. I was definitely enjoying him. When the moment approached for him to finish, he yelped out in pain and suddenly dropped down onto the couch. He was grasping at his head, looking like he was in a complete state of shock and pain. Neither of us knew what was happening. Was it a bad headache? Was it a stroke? Should I call an ambulance? Should I call a taxi? What the fuck should I do? I chose to remain calm. The nurturer came out of me and responded to this scary medical moment like a champ. He needed the calm amidst the storm of the sudden headache. I was legitimately concerned about him and his well-being. I felt awful about the idea of sending him outside to find his way home and to be alone. So I asked him if he wanted to spend the night. He was shocked at my offer, but he knew that I meant the best. He slept in my bed with me, and I didn't get much sleep. I kept waking to check up on him and make sure he was okay. He left as I was getting ready for work the next morning, thanking me for my help and for making sure that he was fine. He told me he never would have expected such kindness and was grateful for it despite his absolute embarrassment. I never heard from him again, and I'm okay with that. I got what I needed from him, and I hope that he got the same. It was that night that I found humanity. It came to my apartment, caught me off guard, and looked me dead in the eyes, telling me it was never going to leave. It was downright scary, a test of all of the things that I've learned, and I've never been the same since. There are plenty of other stories to tell. The man whose wife had left him months ago and didn't know how to date anymore. The couple who I shared their first group experience with. The fetish porn director who said I fucked like I was on an audition. The man who lives across country who calls me for advice. The man who I now call my submissive. Just so many wonderful stories, interactions, and experiences. And they all happen because I allow them to. When you find the courage to live life as the person you truly are, the universe rewards you through the shared experiences with other people. At the end of the day, the problem isn't Tinder. The problem is what we make Tinder. And without Tinder, I don't think these life-changing moments would have ever happened. Within Tinder, there's so little room for judgment outside of a few words and a few pictures. As a result, there's so much room for amazing to happen. When we allow ourselves to be open, people notice and open themselves. And that openness can reveal some pretty fucking awesome people. Humanity is revealed through that openness, and it is fucking awesome. And guess what? So are you.
Thank you so much to Alessia and Violet for kicking us off. And thank you to Erica Iverson, my Know You Tell It partner. She directed the two pieces that you just saw this evening, and she's also going to be quizzing us after the show on all the stories. I'm not kidding. So I hope you're paying attention. I probably should have told you this at the beginning. But you know, not for the second half. But so for the second half of our night, I need the three ladies. And another first, this is the first Know You Tell It triangle that we have. So we're going to see how this all works out. And starting off, since you're starting off. See, I'm confused. Like, all the things. Okay, so kicking off our second half of the evening, we have a story written by Carrie Ha. Yay! So now I've mentioned it like 20 times, but we're all sick. So the question that I came up with for you is, if you could be any place in the world, like I know that here is the number one place you want to be, doing Know You Tell It. So if you had a second choice of anywhere you could be in the world right now, instead of like 2 degrees... New York City with the cold, where would it be?
I would probably be on the warm, sunny beaches of Puerto Rico.
Yeah. Nice.
Would you have, who is, would you bring one of us? Out of all of us, would you bring choose your favorite. I feel like I'm not giving you enough of a question. Now, I'll just, okay. Like, free form. Is there anything you would like to share about your Know You Tell It experience?
It was an amazing experience. I agree with Violet. It's interesting to step back and hear or see somebody else perform your story. Yeah.
Well, that is going to happen right now. So, kicking off the second half of our evening, here is The Photo, written by Carrie Ha and performed by Jessica Cannon.
The Photo. As a child, my grandfather had impeccable instincts into people's character. He saw through people. He could talk to anyone. One time I heard my dad say that he could talk a hungry dog off a meat wagon. He just had a way with people and knew them. My grandfather would often talk about his grandkids. Brian, you'll see. That one is going to be a lawyer. Sure enough, Brian is a partner in his law firm. Doug, he loves attention and making jokes. He'll be a comedian. He'll be someone. And Doug did stand up professionally for 15 years. But when it came to me, Pa would say, here she is. Here's my beautiful granddaughter. Do you see her? She just landed on my roof in a spaceship. She came to visit her grandfather all the way from Jupiter. So I suppose it was validation from an early age that I was different, other, that perhaps I was not so easily defined. This sort of differentness led me to be me. I began to embrace it. It led me to take a different path and make some non-traditional choices, one of which was moving to San Miguel de Allende, Mexico. It's a cobblestoned, idyllic, old colonial town in the heart of Mexico.
Ooh!
Full of artists. It's a place where old gringos retire and take up residence among families and artisans. Where men with donkeys would show up at my window trying to sell me firewood and dirt. Where the children would smile at me and call me güera, which means white girl. I found it by a fluke. I had lost my job at Sesame Street and needed a change. What else is a gal to do who's been kicked by the curb by Elmo? So I settled into a slower way of life there and taught children English and theater, teaching tolerance and self-confidence, pushing them to know it's okay to be creative. It's okay to be themselves. I got to act and reside in this special place, and I thought after living there a total of 3.5 years that I had become part of it. I spoke the language and had Mexican friends. I had gotten a work visa and was finally legal to work there at the fanciest school in town. I had found a place, my place, within the bustling marketplaces, the cacti, and the constant sound of people calling me güera, güera. I had integrated myself here, or so I thought. The day it all changed for me was on Dia de los Muertos, or Day of the Dead, one of the most popular and magical holidays of the year. The town was preparing for a huge arts festival, and to kick it off, famed New York photographer Spencer Tunick was coming down to San Miguel to photograph 150 women. Did I mention that Spencer Tunick's works are large-scale nude installations? We all had been given a secret meeting place at 5 a.m. and were instructed to wear clothes that were easy to take off and on quickly. There were assistants to Mr. Tunick keeping watch and also blocking pedestrians. I'm not sure why I participated. I guess I'd always heard about Tunick's work and was curious. I guess the exhibitionist phase I went through with my friend Skylar, in which he had a naked photo album of his friends derobing in public places, of which I was a star, never really went away. But as it was women only, it felt safe. It felt like something I wanted to experience. It was, after all, for art. A once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. The morning of the event arrived, and I found myself among the women smiling and giggling and shaking. It was about 41 degrees outside, and there was a strange mist that gave an eerie start to the shoot. We had 4 locations to conquer. We all were shedding our clothes and working through the cold and our images of our own bodies and our judgment of others. In a world where so often women are pitted against one another or competitive, I felt a real camaraderie in the group. In that cold morning air, all the worry about my body, how it may or may not look, melted away. We all were working through our self-consciousness, trying to shed all that we carry around with us in our daily lives. All that we try and hide was exposed. It made me feel empowered, strong. We were all in this together. We wore nothing but a garland of bright orange marigolds around our necks. At one point, we were in the bull ring, and I was told by Spencer to kneel. And I kept thinking to myself, I am literally in bullshit. Even though I was freezing, I tried to laugh about the fact that we all have to wade through so much bullshit in our lives. And here I was, knee-deep in it, stripped down to the barest of emotions. I really felt a part of something special that day. Like, this was where I belong. It was an amazing moment in time. I wasn't from Jupiter. I wasn't alien or other. I was one of 150 naked women in the streets of San Miguel de Allende. Or as some news articles said, 150 sinners. On the fourth and last shot of the day, I decided to be bold and stand up front. The trash truck was nearby. Men were sitting on piles of trash with their cell phones out, taking pictures. At this point, news had spread, and many people had gathered snapping shots of us on cell phones and cameras. I started to get self-conscious again. And as Spencer, now frantic, screamed out instructions, I felt my cold, naked body exposed. The guys in the trash truck were yelling to me, "Güera, güera, ¿dónde está tu ropa?" Where are your clothes? Some hours after the shoot, feeling free and brave and like we all shared this secret, my friend, who'd flown down from New York City to participate in the shoot, was looking online. She let out aloud, "Oh my God." There she was. Full bush. Up front and on many a website. We were all over the internet and even on the news. All over Mexico. Photos from amateurs on the side had been leaked everywhere. I was laughing with my friend until we saw the photo. There I was, getting into position for the final shot. Breasts out, butt in the air, marigolds flying. My friend called me, "Oh my God, this picture is horrible. Your chichis are hanging." I started to panic. Who would see this? How could these pictures have been allowed online? I thought about what I'd done in this age of social media, and I started to worry about the choice I'd made. Mm-hmm. I arrived at school the next day. As soon as I walked in, my boss, Miss Judy, gives me that "I saw you" thing with her fingers. Behind her was a teacher I worked with. His face looked horrified. He came up to me and said, "Miss Carrie, I'm so sorry. My wife wouldn't let me look at it, but Miss Judy posted your picture on her Facebook wall." What the fuck? I thought to myself as I ran upstairs to the one teacher I really liked and trusted. As soon as I entered the classroom, she gives me that, "Oh my God, get your ass over here" look. She went to her Facebook, boom. There I was, me and my chichis. With a caption by Miss Judy that says, "Uno, dos, tres, tratar de encontrarme, jejeje." Which means, 1, 2, 3, try and find me. It was like I was a naked white Where's Waldo in this malicious woman's game. I was horrified. I was embarrassed. I was confused and angry. In an instant, all of the positivity from the shoot, the whole experience, the whole morning, the camaraderie I'd felt, all were stripped from me, and I felt more naked standing there in the classroom than I had actually naked in the streets. Another teacher ran in to tell me that Miss Judy, even though she knew I was embarrassed, made sure to show her and another coworker, who weren't on Facebook, the picture of me and tell them what I'd done. I didn't understand. Why? Why would she do this to me? To shame me, embarrass me, make me feel like a fool? What was worse is as the minutes passed on, I realized many of the parents are also friends with Miss Judy on Facebook. Then it really hit me. My students. I was doing a theater workshop with 13 to 16-year-olds. Some of my students in my class were related to Judy. Oh my God. What if all of my teenage boys saw it? Especially Elwa, the French exchange student who was already always teetering on invading my personal space. It was all too much. I quit the job. I could not work for someone who treated me with such disrespect. Someone that inappropriate and unprofessional and really unkind, especially where children are involved. People had their theories. She didn't like me, she was jealous, etc. Whatever the reason, it made me realize that I did not fit in there, that this was never going to be my country, my culture, my language, that I was different, other, undefinable. But at least I'm me. My cousin Brian, the lawyer, who literally makes millions, once told my dad that he was jealous of me, of how I live my life. So now that I'm transitioning back to the beast of New York City, I walk the streets with pride, with confidence, with happiness that I'm exactly where I need to be. This is the city I feel the most alive in, the most myself, the most welcome. I realize we have the power to create the lives we want for ourselves. I live in the freedom. I carry with me all the experiences from Mexico, the good, the bad, and the naked. Maybe New York is like another world, but I have to say, Jupiter is not looking so bad right now. My grandfather would be proud.
Step forward, Katie wrote our second story of the evening. I'm just going to stay here. Are you all right with that?
I'm so okay with that.
Okay. So Katie and I share, I guess, and Erica too. We're all members of Mark Fisher Fitness. So we've shared some ninja journeys together. And I blatantly stole your question from a question I feel like gets asked a lot at the beginning of class. Right. I don't know, maybe you've been in class. They do like a little fun icebreaker question. And the one that's come up a lot is, what is your favorite sound?
Oh.
And why?
Laughter, because it's contagious.
Hey! I've never heard that one before.
Really? No. I feel like I was like, what, again?
No.
Like,
oh, yeah. You know what I always hear they are?
What?
What's your favorite food to use during sex?
What?
All I've never heard they ask that.
What is your favorite food?
Like whipped cream? I don't know. Peanut butter? I don't know. I'm vegan. My choices are so limited.
That would be a downside. I know that the other question I was thinking of, but I couldn't quite phrase it right, was is there an approach to, I know I'm a huge procrastinator, like it takes me forever to get to the gym or this and that, like which do you think is easier, like getting yourself to work out or getting yourself to write? Like, which do you find more like, oh my God?
It was, I think getting myself to write was really, it was hard. Because I would be in my house, and like being motivated in my house, I'm like all the snacks, and like the tea, it's right there.
Yeah, I know, my house gets really clean whenever Well, we are going to see how this all turned out. So switching things up or triangulating them this evening, here is California Dreamin', written by Katie Johnston and performed by Carrie Hoff.
Yeah.
California Dreamin'. I drove the rental car, following closely behind his. We were winding up into some back streets of Los Angeles that I never knew existed. Where the hell was he taking me? My heart was racing. Was I actually doing this? It seemed crazy, reckless. I kept driving. Finally, his car pulled up in front of what looked like a hidden castle built into the Hollywood Hills. He has got to be kidding me. I handed my keys to the valet and joined him at the front entrance. What is this place? I asked, taking in the heavy oak doors and the stained glass windows. I'm not sure what I was expecting, but it certainly wasn't this. He took my hand and led me inside. He draped his arm casually across the front desk as he checked us in. A swarm of butterflies was wreaking havoc on my stomach. I had to remind myself to breathe. He glanced over at me, but I avoided his eye contact by looking around the lobby. I was overwhelmed by the ornate light fixtures and the vaulted ceilings. What was I doing here? He took our key and I followed him through the most luxurious hotel I had ever seen. I was gaping at the artwork on display as we made our way through the maze of halls. Jesus, I hope I'm worth it, I said, only half joking. He stayed quiet, maintaining his air of mystery. I looked down and watched my feet pad clumsily across the plush carpet until we found our room. He unlocked the door and held it open for me. I slowly slipped by him. I stopped short in my tracks and let out a surprised laugh as I stepped inside. I was floored by the absurdity of it all. It was surreal. I stood awkwardly, not knowing what to do with myself in a place like this. He took the bag I was holding and dropped it on the chaise. I felt his hand gently graze the small of my back as he slid behind me. He went to the bar and poured us some cocktails while I continued my inventory of the suite. God, magnificent four-poster bed, heavy floor-to-ceiling drapes. Holy shit, a fireplace? What the fuck? Without a word, he put a glass in my hand and we sipped our drinks in silence. I tried to think of something to say, but I couldn't come up with anything. My mind was spinning. I mean, for the first time in my life, I was speechless. I was suddenly aware of how close I was to him. Close enough to see the gray hairs coming in around his temples. I noticed the crinkles around his eyes had deepened slightly since the last time I saw him. The cuff of his sleeve brushed up against my wrist, and I felt my breath catch. My cheeks flushed, my head was light. God! He was sexy. I couldn't help but smile. He caught me staring and blushed. He smiled a half-smile that made his dimples pop. A mischievous glint flashed across his eyes and gave him a boyish look, despite his age. He put his drink down and crossed the room. I admired his tall, lean silhouette as he headed towards the balcony. He opened the sliding glass door so that we could enjoy the night breeze and a view of the full moon. Seriously? What the fuck? This was a dream. I mean, a scene out of some romance novel that I would be too embarrassed to read on the subway. Not the sort of thing that happened in reality. Certainly not in my reality, anyway. My reality was lonely. It was dull and a little sad. I had chronically bad luck in the romance department. Nothing about this situation even remotely resembled anything in my day-to-day life. Which is probably why I was there. I had been searching for something. For a while. I didn't know quite what it was I was looking for. I just knew it was exhausting trying to fill this void. I was on the brink of giving up completely, and then, out of the blue, I got his message. I mean, I was shocked that he tracked me down in the first place. Even more bizarre was that he reached out right before I was heading back to LA for the first time since I left. He asked to see me, and I surprised myself by saying yes. It made little sense, yet still I found myself, on my last night in town, drinking with a man that I'd only met once before, 2 years earlier. And now, here I was in this hotel with him, just hours before I needed to be at the airport. God, my heart sped up as he walked towards me. He took the half-full glass from my hand and set it down. He took my face in his hands and kissed me. And everything else just melted away. The room, my nerves, any reservations or self-judgment that I had all dissolved until there was nothing left but the two of us in that moment. The rest of the night was a blur. Sultry secrets, big belly laughs, tender touches, absolute abandon. There were moments when I felt more deeply connected to this man than I had to people I've known for years. It was passionate, exciting, and weirdly romantic. This is what I'd been looking for. I mean, not the lavish room, or not the rush of doing something impulsive, and not the charismatic stranger. It was the intimacy, the connection. I found it in this hotel with a man that I might never see again. Reluctantly, I stole a glance at the clock. It was almost 4 a.m. I felt a tug at my heart. I didn't want any of it to end, but I knew that if I didn't leave soon, I'd miss my flight. I rolled over on top of him and asked if he was going to be enjoying the complimentary champagne brunch on the roof in the morning. He said that no, he wouldn't be spending the night. He would head home to finish up some work that he'd put off. He headed into the bathroom, and I tried to convince myself that it was time to get dressed. The soft mattress, mountains of pillows, and luxurious linens made an equally compelling counteroffer. I stretched out and waited for him and replayed the events of the night over and over again in my mind. That's when I heard it. An abrupt sound jolting me away from my thoughts. It took me a second to decipher what it was. Oh, he's in the shower, I realized. Then, that's weird, I thought. Why is he taking a shower? Suddenly a chill went down my spine. Oh my God! I tried to ignore the churning in my stomach, but the hiss of the water was insistent. It was sharp, angry, accusatory. How did I not see this until now? The sound of the running water may as well have been someone dumping a bucket of ice water over my head. It slapped me awake. The dream was shattered. He stepped out of the bathroom, tying a towel around his waist. So, you're not spending the night? Need to get home to your wife? He stopped and looked down. I'm not married. Oh, excuse me, your live-in girlfriend? And his face fell. And with that, I went from being the carefree, spontaneous, sexy thrill-seeker to being the other woman. The dirty little secret. The reason that somebody else would cry one day. I threw back the covers and I searched for my clothes. Wait, he said, please. He took my arm and tried to explain and apologize. I told him I wasn't the one he should be apologizing to. He sat on the edge of the bed, pulled me towards him, and cried. And I know I should have been mad. I should have been furious. I should have stormed out without looking back. But I didn't. I just let him cry. I let him talk. I listened. I wasn't angry. I was sad. I was sad for this man, 11 years my senior, sitting half naked in front of me, pouring his heart out. He was exposed and raw, and he looked lost and confused. It was heartbreaking. I thought about his girlfriend. Was she asleep? Would she wake up when he finally came to bed? Would she wonder where he'd been? Would she believe his story? Would she eventually see the charge for the credit cards on statement? Or would she go the rest of her life loving this man, never knowing what he'd done? Would she stay faithful to someone who made quite an effort to cheat on her? I kept asking these questions as I drove to the airport. I found my seat on the plane and I settled in for my flight, but I couldn't stop thinking about her, the girlfriend, the betrayed. I wanted to be angry on her behalf. I knew that if she found out, she'd be devastated. I knew that it would feel like she got the wind knocked out of her, like someone punched her in the gut. She would feel a tightening around her heart like she couldn't breathe. I knew that. I knew that she would ask why. She would wonder how this could happen. She would demand answers, even though none of them would make a difference. I knew that too. I wondered if she would forgive him. I wondered if she could. I knew that even if she did, there would be a small piece of her that would always wonder if she could ever really trust him again. That small piece would be there forever. It would make her ask how she would ever trust anyone again. It would make her wonder if it was really possible for one human being to ever fully trust another one. It would fuck her up for a long time. Maybe forever, and I knew that. I knew her. I was her. And I wanted to be outraged for the both of us. But I wasn't. I was relieved. I was grateful. Grateful that this time, I wasn't her. I was grateful to be going home. Back to where there would be no one waiting for me. No one who would have missed me while I was gone. No one to lie to me. No one to betray my trust or break my heart. It felt like a gift. It felt like freedom. The dream was over, and for the first time in my life, I was excited to get back to reality.
Jessica!
Okay. I'm afraid of this question.
Why are you afraid of
this
question?
Don't ask me about what food I like to eat.
That was going to be like the sneaky part B. Now you just undercut my joke.
That's terrible.
Now I'm thinking of something new in my brain. My actual question for you, since you wrote our last story of the evening, is both Jessica and Carrie were referred to the workshop by our mutual friend Robin Reed. And so I think Eric and I both always struggle with like coming up with our elevator speech, like what is No You Tell It, and actually listening to the Tinder story, I've been thinking about how many online dates I've been on recently where I'm like, no, it's not like the moth, and I like have to like the whole thing, and then I'm like, right, let's let them talk, and I, you know, and sort of stuff. So I was just wondering what did you think it was? When, like, Robin was, like, whatever it was that caught your eye or she referred you, and then versus your actual experience. Like, was it different than you thought? I'm going to stop talking.
Well, Robin just emailed me and said, dude, take this. Kelly Jean's awesome. And I said, okay, great, because January is usually my dark month. It's the doldrums of winter, and I go, oh, I hate my boots, and I hate the city. So I wanted to do something, and this was sort of something to kick me out of my comfort zone. And Robin had been trying to get me to put my writing out there, because I write all the time, but I never share it with anyone. So this was a good kick in the teeth. But I don't know what I thought. Well, I thought I didn't think it was going to make, like, piss me off so much.
Good.
Because I was like, oh, this is going to be like school. It's going to be so fun. And I had an assignment. And I was like, fuck this assignment. I don't want to do this. This is terrible. But you guys were great. I really enjoyed the Alexander technique stuff you did. And, yeah, you guys were just like, I think you're both really great teachers in that you make us think that we're doing it all on our own. No, because you just have, like, pinpointy little comments to make. It's not all about what you have to say. It's like, oh, think about this little thing. Think about that little thing.
Bring a little hologram of you around.
I recorded it.
Well, finally bringing it home this evening, our last story, My Guilty Heart, written by Jessica Cannon and performed by Katie Johnston.
My Guilty Heart. When does innocence end? When I was 7 years old, I imagined it ended with the knowledge of where babies come from. When I learned that secret, I thought that my carefree days of childhood were over. And it was all Stacy Allen's fault. It's the summer of 1988, and I'm sitting on a rock in the woods near Stacy Allen's house. I'm wearing my pink ballerina bear shirt and my favorite striped shorts. I wish my legs were skinny like my friend Beth's. Even though she has bleeding bug bites all over her legs, they're still skinny and long, and her mom lets her wear short shorts. My mom says short shorts are too grown up and that I can wear them when I can buy my own clothes. Stacy Allen's house is around the corner from Beth's, and it seems very fancy to me because they have a big in-ground pool. I wish we had a fancy pool. And I wish my mom would wear lots of eye makeup like Stacy Allen's mom. It's August, and the air is hot and sticky, and I can hear the filter of Stacy Allen's pool humming in the distance. Stacy has decided to let us play with her today because she has nothing better to do. Beth and I love going to Stacy's house because it's luxurious and a little bit dangerous. Stacy knows a lot about fashion and has every kind of sticker book and makeup set known to man, but she can be unpredictable and pretty darn mean. Even her own mother is afraid of her. Stacy purposely drags the toes of her shoes on the ground when she wants to get a new pair. And she calls her mom a bitch. A bitch and a fat pig when her mom doesn't give in to her demands. Beth and I tread lightly in Stacy's company. She's 10 and we're only 7, so we understand the balance of power. I am polite and agreeable, and Beth is always herself, but at least today she's being the quiet version of herself. Beth swings from a branch hanging above us while I sit with my hands under my thighs waiting for Stacy to tell us the older kid gossip. Stacy has perfect posture and bangs that look like a daisy. Like pieces curled and sprayed up on top go away from her forehead and then pieces curled down on the bottom toward her eyes. Stephanie and Corey kissed. Even though she didn't want to, but he really wanted to, so she just let him. And Marcus got caught stealing candy from Ben Franklin's again. And that girl Shelly peed in her pants at rec camp, and it was so funny, and everyone laughed at her. Suddenly she pauses and says, "And do you know what else?" And then, "Oh, never mind. I can't tell you that." And Beth and I say, "Please," in unison, even though I'm kind of nervous and think that maybe I'm better off not knowing this thing that even Stacy Allen hesitates to say. But then she leans in and says, "Do you want to know where babies come from? It's called sex." She lowers her voice even further and says, "And it's really disgusting." And of course, this interests Beth. death because she loves everything and anything disgusting. She loves to carry black snakes wrapped around her shoulders like feather boas, and she rips the butts off of fireflies and sticks them to her ears to make frightening glow earrings on summer nights. That is all for disgusting. Tell us, she squawks. Well, the man and the woman lay in bed and kiss, and the man puts his penis into the woman's vagina, and they make a baby. And the minute she says those words, I know that I'm not meant to hear them. I know that Stacy Allen is not supposed to be the person to tell me such a monumental thing. I run home and try to unhear everything Stacy has ever said to me. I was born into an Irish Catholic family, and by the time I was 7 years old, the ancestral guilt was strong within me. I once lied about brushing my teeth before bed, and then woke up in the middle of the night to tearfully confess to my bemused mother. Guilt and fear often kept me awake at night. I worried about losing library books and lunch money, and I had a recurring nightmare about my family being boiled in a giant pot by a coven of witches. Knowing how babies are made was way bigger than library books and lunch money. I knew that that information was something that was being kept from me until I was ready to hear it. And apparently I wasn't ready to hear it because my parents hadn't told me yet, and I felt sick with the knowledge. Bedtime became torturous. Lying in bed, I'd feel the spiky flush of guilt creep up my chest and neck, and I would tell myself, you're dirty. You're tainted. Your childhood is over. You ate from the tree of knowledge and you'll never be clean again. You found out where babies come from and your parents didn't tell you. I felt so guilty for knowing the P in the V secret. I kept it to myself. I pretended that I was the same innocent, uninformed kid I was before that fateful day on Stacy Allen's rock. I feigned ignorance at adult jokes and asides. I smashed matchbox cars into the walls with my little brother while trying not to think about just how my parents had made him. That summer, my dad was in a production of Dracula, and I was not allowed to go to the show because it was inappropriate for children. The day after the production ended, Dad wanted to show me a tape of the performance. Mom didn't think it was a good idea, but Dad pressed play on the VCR anyway. The image of a woman in a satin nightgown writhing on a canopied bed with a man rubbing her breasts from behind popped up on our TV. See, do you really want to go into this right now? Do you really want to have to explain this? Said Mom. Nah, you're probably right. It's inappropriate. You can watch it when you're older, said Dad. All I could think was, I already know what's happening, and my childhood is over, and my innocence is lost, and why can't I just unhear the penis and the vagina thing? Why can't I make myself forget? Why? I just want to be small and carefree again, like my little brother. Why didn't I just do myself a favor and tell the truth? I knew what sex was, and I felt terribly guilty about it. I mean, my parents probably would have been embarrassed, but unfazed. I felt I had failed as a child by not maintaining my innocence for as long as possible. 3 years later, when I turned 10, my mother finally gave me the talk, and I felt the relief of 1,000 pee breaks after 1,000 long car rides. I how guilty I had been feeling since Stacy Allen had told me where babies come from. I told her about all the sleep I had lost, but I laughed it off, like, yeah, I was feeling really guilty about knowing what sex is, so I had trouble falling asleep sometimes. I completely underplayed the huge effect it had had on me. And Mom said, oh, you probably weren't that young. No way. She probably told you maybe, like, last year or something. And I just agreed with her to end the conversation and to spare her feelings. I didn't feel safe enough to spill my guts about this thing I still didn't understand, and of course later, I felt guilty for not being completely honest with her in the moment. Where did all of that guilt come from? Who did I feel I needed to answer to? God? My parents? Myself? I wanted to be a good person, to succeed at having a good childhood. I felt I had wrecked my chances with the whole knowing about sex thing, and I had no one there in my head to contradict me or to comfort me and tell me I was being unfair and unkind to myself. If I could somehow speak to my younger self, I would say this. It's okay, my darling. Knowledge is power. You are your own teacher. You are your own friend. You are safe. You are loved. You are living the life you are supposed to live. One day you'll know that sex is beautiful and not just for making babies. All things will become clearer. And do yourself a favor. And stay away from Stacy Allen.
That's it. Thanks for joining us for this installment of Know You Tell It.
Visit us on the web at knowyoutellit.com.